Right. Okay. So thank you very much for joining us today for our latest Employment 101. And welcome back to those of you who have joined us before. And for those of you who haven't and are new to this, we are MPM Legal, a small but perfectly formed, in our view, employment and business immigration practice, supporting HR and management teams to navigate their way through all of the various people issues that seem to be flooding in. I am Adrienne Hardy, although on your screen it probably says that I'm Peter Beastie, but hopefully you'll have figured out that that is not the case. And today I'm joined by my wonderful colleague, Victoria Burnip, who is our immigration partner, and together we run the immigration practice. And what we're going to talk to you today about, and hopefully you know this because you've registered for it, is the right to work checks that you need to take to make sure that you're compliant and avoid illegal working. If you have any questions, please pop them in the Q&A box at the bottom rather than the chat screen, and we will either answer them as we go along or answer them at the end. And if we run out of time, my apologies for that, but feel free to ping us an email and we will do our best to follow up on them. And please don't panic. We won't ever ask you to come on camera or turn your microphone on. So don't worry about that. You will just have the joy of staring at us throughout the session. Okie dokie. So why are we talking about this right to work stuff? I ask myself this question, and it's frankly because it keeps on bloody changing and it's really difficult to keep track of. It's about prevention of illegal working, for which there are civil penalties. And as many of you may know, you can be fined up to £20,000 for each illegal worker. There are criminal penalties. So if you employ someone who you either know is an illegal worker or you have reasonable cause to believe they are illegal, then you can face an unlimited fine and you can go to prison for up to 5 years. In addition to that, scary facts and figures that I've just given you, you can also be named and shamed on the government website. And I had a little bit of a nosy around last night to see what that actually looked like. And it split into area. And for the first quarter of this year in London and the Southeast, which is one area together, there were about 17 fines. And I was kind of interested to see the level of fines. And they ranged from a minimum of 10K up to one business who unfortunately got fined £75,000. So it's pretty scary.
My local Indian takeaway got a 60 grand
really?
Penalty. Yeah. Hopefully they've still got chefs to cook the curry.
Let's hope they're not illegal. I wonder if that means that are we in breach by taking a curry from somebody that we know is employing illegal workers?
I think that's all right. Yeah, I think we've got an exemption there.
I'm really pleased to hear that. And as Victoria will probably tell you as well, this is even more important if you are a sponsor license holder, and if you don't have the right processes and you are found out on a UKVI audit who can come along at any time, you can have your license revoked, meaning that none of your sponsored workers can stay in the UK. So if you think about how important that could be and how damaging to your business, then this is why it's important. So this session is all about having a statutory excuse. And what that means is proof that you've followed the right steps to fend off the immigration inspectors and to defend any penalties or investigations. So, hopefully we haven't scared you witless, but we're going to look at some of the key points. There's a lot to cover in this session, so apologies if we go quite quickly. But I think the first point to note is, when must you do the check? And the simple answer is that you have to do it before your employee starts working for you. And the wording of this requirement has changed a bit. Vic and I were talking about this the other day, because I think, am I right in saying it used to say before their first day and now it says before they start work, or is it the other way around? I can never remember.
Yeah, there's been a kind of subtle shift in the guidance, and they bury it quite deeply within the archives. So you have to go digging around for it. But several years ago, it would say before starting work. So quite a few businesses would, if the start time is 9 o'clock in the morning on the contract of employment, they'd have that worker come in at 8:30, do the check on the first day, and then you're good to go. But in recent months and years, we've seen it creep into before employment commences. So I don't think you can any longer rely on 8:30, 8:59, you know, before the first before the start point on the first day. I think it needs to be done before they even set foot in
through the door
or through their home study, like me.
Yeah.
If they're working from home, before they switch on the laptop that you've given them anyway.
Yeah. And I think sometimes I think our advice is therefore just, you know, if you're recruiting externally, try and get into the habit of doing it at the recruitment stage. So if you get to a second interview or something like that, that would be your opportunity to check. I mean, to be honest, you probably should check before you even start talking to candidates, because there's no point, you know, falling in love with somebody who you think's going to be amazing for your business, only to find that either they don't have the right to work in the UK, and then there's a bunch of other steps that need to be taken, such as sponsorship, and we know how long that takes. You know, it's kind of too late at that point. So get used to getting your recruiters, or if you don't have recruiters yourselves, doing it at that early stage, and then you know you've ticked the box.
And I'm right in saying, aren't I, Adrian, that as long as everyone's treated the same way, there's no issues of discrimination arising by doing it early, if you want to put it that way.
Exactly. Ask everybody.
Yeah.
Ask everybody. Otherwise, you are potentially falling foul of discrimination.
Yeah.
So, Vic, when did these right to work checks start? You're going to run through a bit of a history lesson for us, aren't you?
I am. I was going to do a straw poll, but then I don't want people to have to put their hands up. So, actually, I don't know whether this will surprise people or not, but they started on the 27th of January, 1997. So, before that point, there was nothing. You could employ whoever you wanted. And I don't really know the relevance of the 1997 date, other than that's when the legislation was implemented. And interestingly enough, the rules in place depend on the start date of the employee. So if you are a long established business who happened to take someone on in 1995, say, and they've been busy squirreling away, working for you diligently ever since then, if you don't have anything on file for them, that's not going to be a problem, because the right to work regime at the time you hired them wasn't in effect. And then we've seen a subtle kind of strengthening and a more onerous take on right to work checks gradually creep up. And I've got a complete chronological list of what the right to work checks are since that date, which involved much deep diving in the National Archives. But it changed off and on and stayed fairly regular after May 2014, which is when, up to this year, when we were using List A and List B. So that's, everyone will probably be familiar. This was obviously before Brexit, when it was take a British passport copy or an EU passport copy, and it specified what you needed to do and how you needed to keep it. And it was mostly what we would call manual checks, which is doing a physical check of a hard copy document in the person's presence, and then keeping a copy of it and writing the date and time that you checked it. And then it all kind of started to blow out of the water, first with Brexit and then with COVID. So obviously Brexit made quite a large change to our immigration right to work check system. And when everybody had to apply for pre-settled status or settled status, if they were here before the cutoff date, that had to be built into the right to work check list of acceptable documents. At the same time, UKVI have been trying to phase in a fully digital immigration system, and we've been told that they plan to do that by 2025. They're running out of a bit of time, in my opinion, because they haven't made as much progress as perhaps we thought they would. But they also started to put hard end dates on biometric residence permits for visa holders. So previously, if somebody had a visa and they applied for, say, a five-year visa, the BRP card or biometric residence permit would say this is valid from 2020 to 2025. However, that's no longer the case. BRP cards that have been produced since, I think, about 2020, 2021, have all been ending on the 31st December 2024. And that's not because we're having a massive New Year's Eve party where we chuck everybody out who holds a visa happily. It's just that we've been told that a decision will be made in summer 2024 as to whether we adopt some new generation of BRP technology, or if by that point in time, everybody is moved on to a fully digital immigration status where your status is held in the ether, and you just have to hope the IT system doesn't crash when you're trying to come back into the UK. We started to see as well in 2021, the phasing in of a fully digital application process for EU nationals and non-EU nationals when applying for settled status, pre-settled status or visas. And that meant that some people were being given the fully digital status that I referred to just a moment ago, instead of a BRP. And obviously you can't manually check a fully digital status. So UKVI started to phase in an online right to work check process, which we will touch on later on in this session. And then just to make things even more complicated, we obviously had COVID, where everybody was working from home, or most people were working from home. A lot of that has still continued. And we had the COVID concessions for checking of manual documents, because obviously nobody wanted to be forcing people to come in and touching copy passports when we were all being very careful about the spread of COVID. So up to 30th of September 2022, we had this situation where you could do a manual check of the documents, but online, if that makes sense. So the individual could hold up that hard copy passport on a Teams or a Zoom call or the tech of your choice. You could eyeball it over the internet effectively. And then you could take a copy of that document, a scan of that document from the individual, and just annotate it to say it was what's called an adjusted COVID check. But that all went out the window on the 30th of September. Is that right, Adrienne?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was up until a point, then it extended and then it extended, and then it was finally brought to a close on the 30th of September. So yeah, that's absolutely right.
Okay, so I hope you're with us so far. Yeah. But as you can see, quite a static system, and then over the last couple of years there's been a load of different changes which have meant quite a lot of changes to the overall process. So I think it might be useful, unless you've got anything else to add on that, Adrienne, if I move on to the IDVT process.
Yeah, no, go for it. We've got a couple of questions, but hopefully what Vic's about to outline will answer those questions. But if not, we'll pick up at the after that bit, just to make sure we've captured that. So, yeah, talk about the IDVT process, which I have to confess is something that I've just generally stuck my fingers in my ears and ignored. So you can enlighten me as well.
I think quite a lot of people have done that, actually. Well, it's either IDVT or IDSP, depending on what you're calling it. I think it's ID service provider is the IDSP, which I don't know what the VT in the IDVT stands for, possibly video technology. I'll just take a wild stab in the dark. But yes, this is a new system, or a relatively new system. It actually has been in place since the 6th of April 2022. But I think a lot of people are only starting to take notice of it since that COVID concession ended on the 30th of September, because it was just really easy to do the Teams check. So the IDVT process sounds good, looks shiny, hopefully it will work, but it won't work in every situation. And I think quite a lot of the providers are giving more assurances to their prospective customers than perhaps they should be, from what I've heard from some of my clients. So the IDVT process is a system whereby you essentially delegate part of the right to work check process to a third party IDSP, ID service provider. And you can only use this in certain circumstances and for certain documents. So it's not the kind of one-stop shop that you think it might be, or that you may have read that it is. It can only be used for current passport holders who are British or Irish. So those listening might be aware, people with an expired British or Irish passport can actually use the expired document in order to evidence their right to work, but they won't be able to use this IDVT process because it must be a current, i.e. valid document. There are also other documents that are accepted for British and Irish nationals, but can't be used through this IDVT process. And the most common ones will usually be either a British or Irish birth certificate or adoption certificate, and then a separate piece of paper issued by HMRC, which has the national insurance number on it. And sometimes we come across people who've maybe become British citizens. So they've either registered or naturalised as British, but for whatever reason, they haven't gone that final step and got the British passport yet. So you can accept what's called a certificate of naturalisation, which is issued by the Home Office, again, with that national insurance number document. But you can't do any of the checks on those documents through the IDVT process. It's literally just for current British and Irish passports. So if you have people presenting those alternative documents to you, you will need to go back to the old pre-COVID manual check process of having that person physically come into the office, present the documents for you to check that you photocopy, annotate, and then you pop it on file. The IDVT process, when you can use it, is supposed to take out that first step of the process for you. So the IDSP will run the check for you. And I have to confess, I haven't seen an outcome yet, but from what I understand, it produces a PDF or some kind of electronic document whereby it has a copy of the passport details page. It will have a copy of the individual's picture on, therefore, and it will confirm that they've done a right to work check. And some of our clients thought, brilliant, that'll be job done. But it's not job done because there are additional obligations put on you as the end user of that staff member, the employer, to actually check that that person is who you think they are. So an imposter check is what we're calling it. So it's not enough for you to just save that document from the IDSP on file and go, fine, Joe Bloggs has joined us, working remotely, that's the end of it. And you never meet Joe Bloggs and you never actually eyeball him to see what he looks like. You will need to do this imposter check as well. There's nothing in the guidance that says that has to be in person as things stand. So in my view, you can do that over Teams. You can use that IDVT output, but make sure you jump on a video call with that individual if they're not coming into the office before they start work again. And just make sure that they actually look like their picture. And there are other aspects you need to be aware of, such as if the names don't match, you need to do a bit of deep diving to make sure that there's a reason why. Maybe they've been married or divorced or had a deed poll name change. So it's not a one-stop shop, the IDVT, but I think it will make life easier for people who have lots of remote staff members who it's going to be really difficult to get them to come in before the first day and bring those manual documents in. Of course, nothing comes for free. There is a charge associated with each right to work check you do through the IDSP. And I don't know how much they charge. I think it's quite variable from a couple of pounds up to goodness knows what. So if you're looking at using an IDSP, do check what their charges are. And a couple more points to note on the IDSP before I hand over to Adrienne to talk about online right to work checks. You do need to make sure that there's adequate training in place. So the guidance around the IDSP says, make sure staff members who are actually handling the IDSP requests or IDVT requests know what they need to do, know what they need to send to the provider, and know that they then need to do these imposter checks. It's really important that you don't just save it on file and that you can demonstrate that you've told staff how to do this properly. And there is a list online of, I think the wording is certified IDSP providers. The government says you don't have to use them. So you query why they've produced a certified list in the first place. But I think it's a good starting point. If you're thinking we'd love to use one of these providers to take some of the hassle out of it, but we don't know where to start, I would say have a Google, look for the certified list and choose one of them as your starting point and get several quotes and just see what the cost will be. Does that answer some of the questions that we had, Adrienne?
I think it does. We'll just run through a couple of these. So one question's been asked, do we need proof we've done the imposter check, e.g. annotating the documents again and saving in the file? I think the answer is always yes. And certainly when I come on to talk about the right to work checks, when you work for people with BRPs, there's actually a little box on the bottom to say that that check has been done. And I would absolutely recommend that you've noted it, the person who's done the check, the date, etc., because that way you're demonstrating that you've actually done that. One of the other questions, can recruitment process/interviews prior to getting a copy of the passport be relied on for the imposter check, or must it be done and noted only after the passport copy has been received? I don't really see any reason why you meet the person first online and then the passport copy comes in through the IDTV check, as long as that person is happy to say, oh yeah, that definitely looks like the person I spoke to. I can't see any reason why that wouldn't be possible, can you?
No, I think it's just a question of who's handling the various aspects of the recruitment process. You know, if you have employee X handling the interview, but employee Y delegated to do the imposter check, that they won't have met them. And obviously it relies on whoever's doing the check to remember what that person looked like if it was a giant round of interviews. But yeah, in theory, no reason why that couldn't be done, as long as we remember what the person looked like.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm going to answer a couple of the other questions as we go through. And as Vic said, I'm going to come on to talk now about the online right to work checks. Now, this is very confusing because there are actually two various online bits. The bit that I'm about to talk about is for visa holders who've got biometric residence permits, which now must be checked through the online system. And this is all about share code. So hopefully that's familiar to some of you. So since the 6th of April, only these online checks have been acceptable. So what you need to get the candidate to do is to go to a particular online government website where they can view and prove their immigration status. They log in their BRP number and their date of birth, and that should present a share code. And they then give that to you as the potential employer. You log into a different site, which is View a Candidate's Right to Work, and you put in that share code and the date of birth, and ta-da, hopefully up pops a photograph of the person that you're interviewing with confirmation of their immigration status. And hopefully it'll say, I mean, for obviously with people with settled status, it will say they've got the right to work, or they might have a time limited right to work. For those that need sponsorship, they may already be in the UK being sponsored by another employer. So, you know, then that triggers a different process. But ultimately, that is what needs to be done for those people holding a BRP. And you need to then print off that PDF, do your imposter check, make sure that it does tie in with the person that you're speaking to, tick all the boxes, sign it in blood, I verify that I've done this all properly, and keep it on the file. So that's a different process. So far we're up to two processes. And I think you were going to talk about some special category visa holders where those bits don't work. And then we'll come on to the final category, which is the difficulty of what happens when you're not really sure what to do.
Yeah, it's just a flag really, Adrian, for mainly students, because we see a lot of this. So it's just a kind of cautionary word or two about student visas. First of all, as many of you will probably know, there's a limitation on how many hours per week students can work whilst on here on a student visa. It's usually 10 or 20. And when you do your right to work check, that should reveal what the limitation is. 10 or 20 hours per week during term time, but then full time in vacation periods and after the course has completed. So it's really important that if you are taking on a student that you also obtain additional documents in the form of vacation and term dates from either the university's webpage or some course paraphernalia that the student has, just so that you can show, A, you're aware of what the limitations are during term versus outside of term, and B, that you actually stick by that, because it's really important that you make sure you don't allow students to exceed those working hours. There are also very specific rules about when a student can actually begin a permanent vacancy with a business. And this is contrasted with working full time. So full time doesn't equal permanent vacancy. But as we're running rapidly out of time, I think that's another topic in itself. So if anyone would be interested in a separate kind of session that covers the various myriad rules of student visas, then just drop us an email or pop it in the Q&A below and we'll pick that up separately. So Adrian, right, do you want to talk to us about what on earth you do where someone has a pending visa application or can't give us the right documentation?
Yeah, and actually, hopefully this will answer one of the questions that's been raised. So, you know, we get it quite often. You know, we get a phone call from somebody going, their visa's due to expire next week. We know that. They say they've made an application, but we're not sure what to do. Or worse still, their visa's already expired and they tell us they've made another application. What do we do? The answer is generally, don't panic. You don't say, right, that's it, you're fired. No. So there's a very specific process that you need to go through. And this is another online process just to make it really, really confusing. And this is where you need to go through the employer checking service. And to do that, you're going to need to get details of what application the person says they've made. And they'll normally have some kind of reference number. If they can show you a copy of the application, the reference number will be on it. And you will be able to use that to plug in those details to the employer checking service. And hopefully you will get what's called a positive verification notice. It's a document normally sent out to you. It's a PDF and it's got a big green box on the top saying positive, at which point you can breathe a sigh of relief because it will give you temporary permission or a temporary statutory excuse against illegal working, and it's valid for 6 months. And this is what I think is hilarious. The 6 months is allegedly going to be enough time for that person's new visa application to be dealt with. But Vic and I know, and I'm sure many of you on the call know, that the UKVI is in a right old mess, and 6 months generally is not enough time because they're taking flipping ages to come back with certain applications. So therefore, it's really super important that you diarise that 6 months and you repeat the check. Because if you've got a big green box and it's valid and it's in time, then you can carry on employing that person, no problem. But if you get to the end of that 6 month period and you forget to repeat the check, then you're falling foul of what you're required to do. Absolutely. So hopefully that answers the question that's been asked about doing manual checks. It's really important that you get that positive verification notice through the employer checking service. And again, you can Google that employer checking service. It'll take you through to the bit that you need to do. If you get a negative verification notice, then you're in all world of pain because you then do not have the statutory excuse against illegal working. And this is where the worlds of immigration law and employment law collide with spectacular results, because on the one hand, you've got this big red box saying, no, technically that person doesn't have the right, or they're not sure, it's not clear whether they have the right. So you think, oh my God, am I illegally employing somebody? And so what do? Fire them? Well, employment law says, of course, that when you terminate somebody, you've always got to follow a fair process. So there's two aspects here. If you're sure that this person is an illegal worker and you are very clear on that, then their contract is void for illegality and you cannot employ them, and they're not entitled to notice and not entitled to any rights. But of course, you've got to do an investigation first. So this is where you kind of have to make a bit of a call. And I always get sort of... I never know which side to go on this. If while you're investigating all of this, of course, you're carrying on employing them. And if you're employing them and they're an illegal worker, then you're at risk of falling foul of the immigration rules. If, however, you fire them, then potentially you're falling foul of employment laws if they've obviously got more than 2 years service and potential for discrimination claims. So frankly, it is a nightmare. And one of the things that Vic and I were talking about was whether or not having the right to suspend them, whether paid or unpaid, would help. And I think we have different views, don't we? Because I think you thought it could be useful. And I was like, well, surely, a tough ass immigration officer could come in and go, well, if that you've suspended them and you're not paying them, doesn't stop you from the fact that you are actually still employing them.
Yeah, I've written a fair few unpaid suspension when we're in doubt as to the legality of someone's work into contracts of employment. Because in my view, I think if they're not working and we're not paying them, then they're just notionally on the books at that point. And that potentially helps you kind of bridge this chasm between employment law and immigration law, where you can at least make sure you still employ them in the employment law sense, but you're not giving them any of the benefits or requiring any services from them, which would then fall foul of the immigration regime.
Yeah.
But happily, none of my clients have really had to test this one out so far. The reason we're doing today is to make sure that no one on this call does that either.
Yeah.
So I think, see if you disagree with me, Adrian, but consider an unpaid suspension clause in your contract of employment where you have reasonable suspicion or reasonable belief that either someone's working illegally or they cannot document that to your, they cannot document their right to work to your satisfaction, it might be helpful. And you don't have to use it if you don't want to.
No. And I don't think that means you all need to panic and, you know, start rewriting your contracts and reissuing them to existing staff. It's something that you can potentially think about. But, you know, whether or not it works or not, it will probably depend very much on the investigation officer, if you ever get investigated, and, you know, whether they've had a particularly bad day or whether you can say, well, look, we've got all these other systems in place. We're clearly marvellous and take our duties very seriously. And then they're quite kind to you. But yeah, it's not an easy one, which is why we're running this session. So hopefully you're not in that position. So can I just, before we sort of come on to some pitfalls and some practical tips, let's just run through a couple of the questions asked, just to hope that we've answered them. So one of the questions asked, is a photo of the ID okay initially, or do you need to see the original at second interview, for example? Well, hopefully I think we've answered that to say you really do need to get this sorted before they start work. So photo of the ID is not going to be compliant of its own. Got to do one of the three things, the manual check, the IDTV, the online check for BRPs, worst case scenario, employer checking service. And I think I've answered this next question was about if there's a pending application. Somebody's then said, I wanted to ask about face-to-face checking of documents and then train strikes happen. How do we complete the checks as we can't do the first day in person? Unfortunately, UKVI frankly don't really give a toss about train strikes, and that won't give you the statutory defence that you need. So, it comes back around to saying, well, you know, worst case scenario, you've got to find a way to do the manual check, or you might have to postpone their start date. But really, if you're trying to be super squeaky clean and meet the gold standard, then yeah, you've just got to follow the process.
I think it depends as well. I mean, if you've got the IDVT process up and running, obviously you could use that.
Yeah.
But not everyone will want to go to the costs associated with that. So yeah, it might be worth having a setup where you can, I don't know if this is possible, but if an IDSP can say, you can use this on an as needed basis. So if these dratted train strikes continue, then at least you've got a backup option that you can do it through that process. But that's really an advocate for doing it early doors as well, before employment commences, so that you're not caught on day one with that person not being able to come in.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Hopefully I've answered the issue about the share codes and the sort of the group of people that you can use that for. Somebody else has answered a really good question. What if the candidates change their appearance between passport issued and the check? Beard growth, dyed
yeah,
hair,
that.
Different
one.
Glasses. Yeah, it's and they said, I guess not for women, which did make me chuckle.
Yeah.
It's all about you satisfying, you know, if you're satisfied that it's the same person, and that's why it's so important to do that check. So
you can ask for further photographic ID as well as an additional document. So you might try and think what might work, a driving license.
Yeah, that's a good
or
point.
Expired passports, if although they should look like a more recent passport than a more expired passport. But yeah, it's your duty to satisfy yourself that they are the right person, and it's nothing to stop you asking for additional paperwork for a name change. And the same goes for a facial or appearance change.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
What would you recommend for remote workers if they do not come into the office for interviews? I think we've covered again IDTV. If it's BRP or BRC holders, they can do that. Are driving licenses valid for right to work checks? No, they're not. This is coming back to the documents that are in list A and list B. So it's really, really important to make sure that if you're doing the manual checks, that you make sure that that they are possible for the type of person that you're interviewing, and also that they are producing the right documents that you can use. And what have I missed any?
There's a final question. Sometimes we get a passport with a picture where they're very young, no longer looks like the person in the question. Can we reject and ask them to get a new passport? It's quite expensive to ask someone to get a new passport. I think if we're talking British and Irish nationals, who are the only people you can accept passports for now, you would look to alternative documentation in that instance. So it would be a birth certificate, a national insurance number is usually your backup option. I don't think you can really force someone to spend think over £100 now for a passport.
And wait forever. And wait as well, potentially.
However long. Yeah, because that's as long a queue as the visa queue. So
yeah.
We've
okay,
got time to just run through some pitfalls, Adrian.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah, hopefully we've gone a bit over, but hopefully everybody is still on. Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so I'm just going to cover some pitfalls, and then we're going to try and wrap up with some practical tips for everyone, I think. So we do a lot of mock audits for our clients. Very happy to come and do one for you if you'd like us to. And I just thought I'd run through the sort of things that we regularly see when we do them. Things like poor copies, and by that I mean instead of a face, there's just a black box or a blob that is unrecognizable. You might have seen the original document and verified that person was who they say they are, but your records show nothing other than just a generic human being. So do make sure that your copies are good enough quality that it can be checked and verified that it relates to that individual. And also that you're annotating properly. So again, this is just back to British and Irish passports where you're still doing the manual check. Make sure you're not just doing an indecipherable squiggle of a signature on them. Yeah, we would say you should put something like, we verify this is a true likeness of such and such, checked on time, date, signed, position. So make your annotations decent. And so that's the main pitfall I think we would see. We also see sometimes the wrong documents being accepted. So a driving license, as somebody raised, that would be a classic example of this. That's not an acceptable document. One that catches a lot of people out is an indefinite leave to remain sticker or stamp that's in an expired passport. And I think it's because we know we can accept expired British and Irish passports, and this leads people down the wrong path when it comes to ILR. So the indefinite leave to remain sticker, which they're no longer really issuing anyway, it should be on a biometric residence permit, but we still do see these sometimes. If they're in an expired passport, that person needs to move that sticker into a BRP using a free application called an NTL or no time limit application. So please don't accept an ILR stamp or sticker in an expired passport. You will not have a defence if that person subsequently turns out to be working here illegally. Then the final two that I just wanted to flag is not diarising expiry dates. So it's all very well thinking, great, we've got a 6-month employer checking service check, or great, this person's on a spouse visa for 2.5 years. But if you don't then recheck at the end of the relevant period, you're going to be in a world of pain. So please do make sure, and don't just diarise the last day because it's too late by that point. We would say 3 or 4 months prior to make sure that you're picking up with that person saying, hey, what are you doing in terms of beyond the expiry date? Are you extending your visa? Has anything changed? And now a big pitfall since 6th of April 2022 would be taking manual document copies of BRPs, because they can no longer be manually checked. So do not just scan a front and back copy of a biometric residence permit, whether they're sponsored or they're not sponsored. You can't take a manual copy of that anymore. You must use the online right to work check for all visa holders since April this year. So go and have a little look through your files and just make sure that's been done. And then shall we close with some practical advice for people?
I think we've covered the first one, haven't we? We've said kind of build this into the recruitment process at the start, get it done early, and then you just don't have that panic when somebody's about to walk through the door / log onto their computer for the first time and you go, oh, not sure we've done that right to work check. Or worse still, you come to us and say, hey, we need a sponsor license. And we go, right, there's a bunch of stuff we just want to check first in terms of compliance. What do your right to work check look like? And then you go through and you realise actually that it's all a bit of a disaster and that needs to be resolved. So, you know, good practice, getting into good habits, getting into good practices will stand you in good stead. Now, you may say to, you might be saying to yourself, we're never going to get a sponsor license. We don't need to do it. Well, in our experience, it's better to be prepared, because a number of times we get clients coming to us going, oh, we found somebody absolutely brilliant, but they need sponsoring and we need a sponsor license. And we go, yeah, it's going to take a while to do it. That's bad enough in the process. If you then have to get your house in order before you even start to apply for the sponsor license, it's just adding more time. Candidate potentially gets fed up and goes somewhere else. So get into those good habits. You mentioned training.
Yep, very important.
Yeah, training for your managers who are looking after the right to work checks to make sure that they know what they're doing. So that can be a talent acquisition team or anybody anybody who is responsible for bringing on your staff, and getting used to that active monitoring and record keeping. The diarising of time limited permissions is super critical.
Not just in a spreadsheet either, which is a lot of people, because I always say if you're knocked down by a bus, no one's going to be checking that spreadsheet. So no. Please make sure it's Outlook, other email web apps are available as well. Have it so it pops up in diaries, not just in one person's, in a few people in the HR or the talent team. So that is definitely caught.
Okay. We kind of ran over time. A lot of people have asked if they can have access to this recording. The answer is yes, absolutely. Once we edit it, which cuts out all the chatting that we do before the session actually starts, it goes up on our website. But also these sessions go up as audio files on our Spotify podcast channel. Look how up with it we
cool
are.
Cool we are.
So yeah. I know, right? So if you go onto Spotify, look up NPM Legal Employment Law 101, and you will find all of last season's sessions there, and you will also find these when we upload them. So listen while you're going for a run or walking the dog, or if at any time you can't sleep, and if you're desperate, as I said, desperate to watch this again, then these sessions will appear up on our website. What I think I might do is add a couple of the links to the employer checking service and the right to work online check sites when we send out the blurb for our next session, so keep your eyes peeled for that. And all that remains is to say, hopefully join us again in 2 weeks for our next session.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.